The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com.
Hypnagogia by Manuel Garcia. The whistle of the kettle dragged Carla out of sleep like a hand yanking her upward. She jerked halfway off the mattress, one arm braced behind her, staring at the bedroom door. For a moment, she didn't move. She wasn't even sure she was awake. The kettle kept going, shrill and insistent, until it cut off mid-note. Silence followed. Brief, thin, then the soft clatter of something in the kitchen. Metal against ceramic. A drawer sliding open. Somebody moving things. Her stomach dropped. She swung her legs out of bed, grabbed a robe, and wrapped it around herself with shaking fingers. She stepped toward the door, pausing just before the threshold. She leaned out just enough to see down the hallway. The rummaging stopped. A faucet turned on. Ran for a second. Turned off. Hello? Her voice cracked on the last syllable. A beat, then a dull thud, like a cup set down too hard on the counter. Her pulse hammered in her ears as she walked down the hallway, each step careful, deliberate. Hello? She called again, as if volume might provoke something. She reached the kitchen. The stovetop glowed faintly, the red coils fading as they cooled. No cup. No kettle, no sign of anything disturbed. The air smelled faintly of steam, but that could have been her imagination. She checked the living room, the spare bedroom, the bathroom. When she returned to the kitchen, she stood still for a long moment, listening to the quiet press in around her. Her heartbeat felt too loud, like it didn't belong to her body. Then a door slammed. She flinched hard, spinning toward the hallway. The sound had come from her bedroom, she was sure of it, but the bedroom door was still open, light from the window spilling calmly into the hall. Her breath stuttered. A sound drifted out, barely there, a soft, uneven sobbing. A woman. Carla swallowed, forcing her feet to move. She walked toward the bedroom, each step slower than the last. The sobbing thinned as she approached, fading like someone turning down a radio. By the time she reached the doorway, it had stopped completely. The room waited in perfect stillness, exactly as she'd left it. She stood there, one hand gripping the doorframe, the other pressed to her chest, unable to speak, unable to understand why the air felt so heavy, why it felt like she had just missed someone by seconds. The rest of the morning passed in a fog. Carla moved through her routine with the brittle focus of someone trying not to think too hard. She showered, dressed, made toast she barely tasted. She kept glancing toward the hallway as if expecting a sound to follow her out the door. Nothing did. Work was mercifully dull. Emails, small talk, the hum of fluorescent lights. She told no one about the morning. She didn't even let herself replay it. Every time her mind drifted toward the memory of the kettle or the sobbing, she shut it down like a closing window against a draft. By the time she drove home, the sky was already dimming. The house looked normal from the outside, quiet, still, unremarkable. She unlocked the door, stepped inside, and felt the familiar weight of the place settle around her. Her phone rang. Michael. She answered, already bracing herself. He sounded tired. She sounded tense. The argument wasn't dramatic, just a slow, grinding kind that comes from distance and repetition. He'd been gone too long. He didn't know when he'd be back. She didn't know how much longer she could pretend that was fine. They talked in circles until neither of them had anything left to say. When she hung up, her chest felt tight, like she'd been holding her breath for hours. She went to bed early. Sleep didn't come easily. She lay on her side, staring at the faint glow of the streetlight through the curtains, listening to the house settle. Every creak made her flinch. Every shift of the air felt like a presence. Sometime before midnight, she heard the shower, a steady rush of water behind the bathroom door. She sat up slowly, heart thudding. The sound was unmistakable. The pressure, the rhythm, the way it echoed off tile. She waited for the shadow of feet beneath the door. There was none. She stood, walked to the bathroom, and pushed the door open. Dry floor, cold air, silence. She backed away, pulled bracing, and returned to bed. She pulled the covers up to her chin and tried to breathe evenly. A few minutes later, the faint murmur of a television drifted from the living room, the low, indistinct chatter of a show she couldn't quite place. She stared at the bedroom doorway, waiting for the flicker of light on the wall. It never came. She got up again, walked down the hall, and found the living room dark. The TV was off, the remote untouched. She stood there for a long moment, arms wrapped around herself, listening to the quiet press in from all sides. Eventually, she went back to bed. She lay awake until exhaustion finally pulled her under. Carla woke before sunrise, the room still dim and colorless. Her body felt heavy, her mind fogged from a night of broken sleep. She moved through the house quietly, as if afraid to disturb something she couldn't name. In the kitchen, she filled the kettle and set it on the stove. The burner clicked on. She folded her arms and waited. When the whistle began, sharp and rising, she winced. It was the same sound that had yanked her awake yesterday. She turned it off quickly, almost too quickly, and poured the water. When she set the cup down, it hit the counter harder than she meant, a dull, hollow thud that made her flinch. She rinsed the spoon under the faucet. The water hissed, stopped. She carried the tea toward her bedroom, but as she reached the doorway, her grip slipped slightly. She pushed the door open with her shoulder, and it swung wider than she expected, slamming against the wall with a sharp crack. She sat on the edge of the bed, took a sip of tea, and felt the warmth rise behind her eyes. She set the cup down and pressed her palms to her face. The sobs came quietly at first, then in small, uneven bursts. She wiped her face, embarrassed by the intensity of it, and stood abruptly. She walked out to the living room where her keys lay on the entry table. She picked them up, the familiar jingle of metal against wood, and closed her hand around them. Carla opened the front door and stepped outside. The air was cool, the street empty. She pulled the door shut behind her. She started jogging, letting the movement steady her breathing. The neighborhood was waking slowly, a porch light turning off, a dog barking somewhere far away. She made it halfway down the street before she stopped, not because she was tired, but because the memory hit her all at once. The kettle, the thud, the faucet, the sobbing, the door slam, the keys. Every sound she had heard yesterday morning, she had just made. She turned back toward the house. From here, the front door looked still, closed, harmless. But she could see it in her mind, herself on the other side of it yesterday, ear pressed to the wood, listening with held breath, listening for this, for her. A strange, hollow feeling opened in her chest as if she had stepped out of herself and left another version behind. She walked slowly back up the street, eyes fixed on the door until she reached it, then stopped. Carla stood there, staring at the door, wondering, impossibly, if she was still on the other side. The morning felt thin around her, like she could push through it and find herself. Carla stepped back into the apartment slowly, closing the front door behind her with a soft, deliberate click. She didn't move at first. She just stood there, hand still on the knob, listening to the quiet settle around her. Her eyes drifted to the door itself, to the exact spot where she had stood yesterday morning, standing at the kitchen entrance, breath held, listening for sounds she couldn't explain. There was nothing. She stepped back, studying the door as if something might appear if she looked long enough. But the entryway remained ordinary, painfully ordinary, as if the house were trying too hard to pretend nothing had happened. She walked deeper inside, but she kept glancing back at the kitchen door as though she might catch herself standing there again if she turned quickly enough. The rest of the day passed in a blur. She made dinner but barely tasted it. She tried to read but couldn't focus. Every sound in the apartment felt slightly off, slightly delayed, as if the house were breathing a fraction of a second out of sync with her. By nightfall, she felt wrung out. She decided to shower, hoping the heat and steam might settle her nerves. She closed the bathroom door firmly and turned on the water. The room filled with steam, fogging the mirror, softening the edges of everything. For a few minutes, the sound of the water was enough to drown out her thoughts. When she stepped out, towel wrapped around her, she froze. The bathroom door was open, wide open. She stared at it, water dripping from her hair onto the tile. She remembered closing it. She remembered the weight of it in her hand, the click of the latch. She stood there for a long moment, heart thudding, then forced herself to move. She dressed quickly, left the bathroom light on, and walked into the living room. She turned on the TV. The glow filled the room, warm and familiar. She sank onto the sofa, pulling a blanket over herself. The noise helped. The light helped. Eventually, her eyes grew heavy. She drifted. 1 minute passed. 2 minutes. The TV clicked off. She stirred, half asleep, assuming the sleep timer had kicked in. The room was dark now, the only light the faint spill from the street lamp outside. She shifted slightly, adjusting the blanket. Behind her, someone stood, a presence, still, close. Carla didn't turn, not yet, but she felt it, the weight of another body in the room, the quiet, steady breath that wasn't hers. And then in the reflection of the darkened TV screen, she saw it, a woman, standing behind the sofa, holding the remote, her own face, her own posture, her own eyes staring down at her. Carla. A Highway with No Traffic by Jonathan Page. If the stars should appear one night in a thousand years, how would men believe and adore and preserve for many generations the remembrance of the city of God which had been shown? Ralph Waldo Emerson. Not a single star pierced the night. Quinn had been walking since before sunrise, his pack digging harder into his shoulders with every mile. The high-voltage lines hummed overhead, occasionally hissing at him. Desert dust coated his throat, turning every breath shallow and raw. Smoke burned his eyes and nose and turned the desert gray. The moon hung red behind the smoke. Quinn followed the high-voltage line south. He had spent most of his life running cable through walls and conduit, joining one end of a system to another. Breakers, switches, outlets, small points of connection leading back to a source no one ever thought about until it disappeared. Now most of the lights were gone, yet current still moved through the lines above him. Damaged conductors arced in the wind, dropping sparks into the dry brush. Quinn had once imagined buying a farmhouse where he and Rebecca could build a life away from everything. Rebecca had always treated her own life as something that could wait. Each morning she woke impatient to return to the laboratory, convinced the answer was somewhere beneath her microscope. Quinn wondered whether she had ever stopped to ask what saving the world would cost her. Cabreza Prieta lay nearly 500 miles from Las Vegas. Rebecca would be heading there, too. At the rate he was going, the journey would take 2 weeks. He walked into the night, trading sleep for miles. The headlamp cast a single spot on the ground before him. After 3 hours in darkness, Quinn began falling asleep on his feet, weaving between the lines. Unable to go any farther, Quinn found a patch of open ground and sat down on a wool blanket, utterly alone. The katydids still sang. Coyotes argued across the canyon. Bats stitched loops through the darkness. Nature hadn't noticed humanity was ending. The day Quinn left Vegas, he stood in line at a roadside produce stand outside Henderson, waiting to barter for whatever remained. The stand had once sold peaches, local honey, and baskets of tomatoes to tourists driving toward Lake Mead. Now the plywood shelves had dented cans, bruised vegetables, and cartons of unrefrigerated eggs. A handwritten sign had been nailed above the counter. cash, silver, gas, medicine, ammunition, no cards. 20 people waited beneath a faded canvas awning. Most held something they hoped could still be traded. Jewelry, tools. One man carried 3 rolls of copper wire over his shoulder. Quinn had brought a cordless drill and a half bottle of bourbon. An old .38 waited in the glove box in case barter failed. He needed water more than food. Rebecca would have laughed at the bourbon. He finally found something useful to do with it. He had not heard from her since the cell phones went dead months earlier. The woman ahead of him traded a wedding ring for 2 gallons of water, 6 eggs, and a can of peaches. She held the eggs against her chest as though someone might take them. The man running the stand inspected Quinn's drill and placed it beneath the counter. I can give you canned beans and a gallon of water. That drill costs $300. Then you should have sold it when dollars were worth something. Quinn looked past him at the remaining supplies. 2 plastic gas cans sat beside a stack of empty milk crates. How much for the gas? Not for sale. I've got bourbon. A low concussion rolled across the valley. The jars on the shelves rattled. Everyone turned toward Vegas. For a moment, nothing changed. Then a column of black smoke rose behind them. A second explosion followed. Closer this time. The ground trembled beneath Quinn's boots. Car alarms began sounding in the parking lot. One after another, then all at once. A fire alarm shrieked from the motel across the highway. Sirens started somewhere to the north. Hands reached over the counter. Someone seized a case of water. Another person grabbed both cartons of eggs and ran. The man behind the stand shouted and pulled a shotgun from beneath the register. A third explosion rolled through the valley. Far across Henderson, the power went out in sections. Traffic signals died. Storefronts went dark. A transmission line flashed white against the mountains, followed by a burst of orange fire. Smoke swept across the highway in a single dark wall. Within seconds, the sun became a red coin behind it. Quinn wrapped his shirt across his nose. People screamed without knowing why. Cars backed into one another as drivers fought to leave the lot. Someone fired a gun. The shotgun answered. The gas cans were still beside the milk crates. Quinn moved toward them. So did a man in a camouflage jacket. They reached the nearest can at the same time. The man caught the handle first. Quinn grabbed the bottom. Let go. I need it. So do I. Quinn drove his shoulder to the man's chest. He seized the can and ran. Behind him, the shotgun fired again. The radio came on when he started the engine. Every station carried a different version of the same ending. An attack on a switching station. A military strike. A coordinated uprising. The Federal Emergency Network instructed residents to remain indoors. Then static swallowed the radio lines. For days, the country had been coming apart. Federal troops had fought civilians for control of East Coast fuel terminals. Armed coalitions in California had seized reservoirs, ports, warehouses, and substations. Quinn pulled onto the highway. Traffic had already stopped. Cars filled every lane, some facing south, others north, others abandoned at angles between them. People ran along the shoulders carrying children, bags, rifles, and plastic containers. Quinn drove onto the shoulder, crossed a drainage ditch, and pushed through a break-in chain-link fence. The truck bounced over hard desert ground. He headed for the transmission corridor south of the highway. The towers were easy to follow, dark steel frames marching through the smoke. The road disappeared behind him. The track narrowed between exposed rock and a dry wash. The rear tires spun in loose sand. The truck sank to its axle. He sat behind the wheel while the engine idled. He poured in the stolen gas and tried once more. The tires only buried themselves deeper. His knuckles were split from fighting for fuel that had carried him less than 6 miles. Night came without a sunset. Quinn locked the doors and climbed into the back seat. He rested the .38 revolver between his legs, both hands wrapped around the grip. Outside, the transmission lines hummed in the darkness. In the morning, Quinn turned south and began walking beneath the power lines. The verdict had been delivered years earlier. Quinn could not pinpoint the moment people finally accepted it. 4 years ago, there had still been baby showers, the occasional baby sprinkle, and over-the-top gender reveals. Then all at once, everything changed. 3 years, 6 months, and 12 days ago, the Director General of the World Health Organization had looked into a camera and pronounced civilians' death sentence. No human pregnancies have been confirmed for 90 days. No explanation was given. No one had found one since. Now the playgrounds were empty. For nearly 3 years, people pretended life would continue. They went to work. They voted. They planned vacations. They fought in wars. Then they stopped pretending. Scientists blamed endocrine disruptors, unidentified viruses, even divine judgment. Every week, another certainty replaced the last. People divided into camps. Protests erupted over theories no one could prove and cures no one could produce. Professor Konstantin Orlov claimed a child was never made from DNA alone. Every child began as hope shared by two people. Rebecca saw it differently. The answer, she insisted, was in the blood. On Friday afternoon, Quinn and Rebecca had driven south from Las Vegas on a highway that should have been crowded. Instead, all three lanes were empty. No tractor trailers, no commuters, no families heading out for the weekend. Their car moved alone beneath the signs and overpasses while the desert stretched outward on both sides. Quinn looked across the vacant lanes. It's a highway with no traffic. Rebecca turned toward him. What did you say? A highway with no traffic. She stared through the windshield. That's what the blood looks like, she said. Quinn glanced at her. What does? The signals that tell the immune system to tolerate pregnancy are missing. What signals? The immune system has to protect the mother without attacking the life taking root inside her. She pulled an old receipt from the cup holder and began writing across the back. Quinn watched her fill the paper with arrows, abbreviations, and circles. The Torah calls blood the life of the flesh, she said. You're quoting scripture now? I'm saying people always knew blood was more than plumbing. She underlined something twice. And ours has changed. But why? Rebecca kept writing. I know what changed, she said. I don't know what changed it. By the time they reached Henderson, the receipt was full. Months later, on the morning Rebecca left for the Antares Project, Quinn handed her a folded map. What is this? She asked. The Devil's Hideaway. She opened it across her suitcase. A route had been marked through Cabeza Prieta in red ink. And what am I supposed to do with it? Hang it on my wall? If things get bad and we get separated, you meet me there. Things are bad. They're going to get worse. Rebecca folded the map along its original creases. Why there? It's wilderness. People will stay away. People die out there. People die everywhere. She looked toward the platform where the train was waiting. Quinn caught her hand before she could turn away. If everything falls apart, he said, where do you go? Rebecca looked down at the map. A highway with no traffic. That's right. Then she nodded once, placed the map inside her bag, and boarded the train. Quinn had stopped trying to decide who was right. He shouldered his pack and stepped beneath the power lines again. Whether humanity deserved saving no longer mattered. Rebecca did. The day after Rebecca arrived at Kitt Peak, she climbed the steel stairs to the Mayall telescope. The Antares project had assembled astronomers, reproductive biologists, and hematologists to search for a cause no single field could explain. Rebecca had expected the first answer to come from the blood. Instead, it appeared in the sky. By the time darkness settled over the Quinlan Mountains, the white dome had rotated toward another carefully selected patch of sky. From Kitt Peak, the desert unfolded in gold and rust beneath a smoldering western horizon. The observatory domes stood in silent vigil above the mountains, waiting for darkness the way cathedrals wait for prayer. The sky did not merely grow dark. It awakened. As the last crimson faded from the west, one star became 10, then hundreds. The Milky Way stretched from horizon to horizon until the mountains themselves glowed silver beneath it. That first night, the spaces between the stars had seemed larger than she remembered. She blamed insomnia and caffeine. The first absence Rebecca found lay near the Witch's Head Nebulae beneath the cold blue light of Rigel, where young T. Tauri stars were still being born. The star should have been there. V-222, Ori, appeared in every archived image and none of the current ones. Rebecca checked the optics and detector, then compared observations from telescopes across the globe. Each showed the same empty patch of sky. V-222, Ori, was gone. 2 days later, Rebecca watched another star vanish. Stars did not simply disappear. They swelled, faded, collapsed, or exploded across immense spans of time. They did not blink out between observations. Satellite streaks, debris, and atmospheric distortion could corrupt an image. None could erase the same star from every telescope across the globe. Rebecca logged the discovery, reported it to headquarters, and returned to the pre-collapse and post-collapse blood samples. The cactus wrens woke her before sunrise, scolding from the ridge with their mechanical char, char, char. Rebecca watched birds for the same reason she studied blood. A flock revealed changes no individual creature could. When conditions failed, migratory birds left. Maybe the stars were migrating, too. Months later, they ate breakfast beside the overlook. The overlook had once been crowded with tourists. Now only Rebecca, Orlov, and a handful of cactus wrens remained. The wrens gathered along the overlook fence. Rebecca lowered her coffee. They don't migrate. Orlov watched them lift from the ride together. They do now. The flock wheeled and streamed south, gliding with the terrain until they disappeared from view. Orlov turned and looked at Rebecca. You keep saying the stars disappeared, Orlov said. They did. No, you measured their absence. What's the difference? The stars may still be there. Then where is their light? Orlov looked toward the empty sky. Perhaps they aren't sending it here anymore. Light doesn't choose. They were never merely lights. They were witnesses. To what? Us. And now? Now they've looked away. She began printing the star maps and laying transparent overlays across them. Each morning she circled another missing point of light in red ink. Soon the maps were crowded with red circles. The WHO had estimated the date of the last known conception. V-222, Ori, had vanished within 48 hours of it. She checked the timeline 3 times. Rebecca leaned back from the screen. The missing stars did not frighten her nearly as much as the possibility that they were keeping count. When smoke climbed the mountain and fire appeared below the overlook, Orlov emerged carrying his stainless steel thermos. "It's time, Rebecca." "But we haven't finished." "If we are here when the fires reach us, we'll be finished." "We'll never find Quinn out there." "Have some faith, Rebecca." "You know I'm not that kind of girl." The old Ford rattled along the Devil's Highway, pulling smoke behind it through the broken rear window. Quinn had found the truck abandoned beside a dry wash and jumped the ignition with wire from his pack. The fuel gauge has not moved in 20 miles. Ahead, an old gas station emerged from the haze. One pump leaned sideways beneath the collapsed canopy. Sand had blown across the asphalt and gathered against the doors of the convenience store. The windows were dark. Quinn saw something orange move behind the glass. He hit the brakes. The truck skidded to a stop 50 yards beyond the station. A faint light flickered inside the store. Not electric, a candle. He left the engine running and stepped down with a .38 in his hand. Wind pushed dust across the lot. Thunder rolled somewhere beyond the mountains. The store's glass door was locked. Quinn looked through it. Empty shelves, an overturned rack of postcards. "Rebecca?" He struck the door with the side of his fist. "Rebecca!" Something moved behind the counter. A figure stood slowly. The orange gaiter covered the lower half of her face. It was the ugly orange gaiter she always wore in the desert, the one Quinn remembered from every trail where she stopped to watch cactus friends. She pulled it down. For a moment, Quinn could not speak. He had imagined her face too many times beneath the power lines. He no longer trusted the sight of it. Rebecca crossed the store and unlocked the door. Neither of them moved. "You're late," she said. Quinn lowered the revolver. "I drove as fast as this thing would let me." A drop of rain struck the pavement between them, then another. Rebecca stepped outside. Quinn touched her cheek as if he still needed to be sure. "You found me," she said. "No." He looked at the orange gaiter around her neck. "You made it difficult to miss you." The wind lifted behind them, carrying the smell of rain into the smoke. Then Rebecca put her arms around him. "Where's Orlov?" "Looking for fuel. Our truck died half a mile back." Quinn looked her in the eye. "Did you find it?" Quinn asked. "Part of it." Inside the store, Rebecca spread several folded pages along the counter. "The regulatory T cells and uterine natural killer cells are no longer balancing the immune response. The body never receives the signal to prepare for pregnancy. The highway is intact, but nothing travels it." "A highway with no traffic." She nodded. "I found where it fails, not why." "And the SARS?" "That's the part I can't explain. The blood, the birds, the stars, something changed all of them." "Then we keep looking." Rebecca studied him. "You wanted me to leave all this behind." "I wanted you safe." "In your farmhouse?" Quinn nodded. "I kept trying to decide what our life should look like before we had one." Rebecca looked down at the papers. "And I kept acting like ours could wait until I finished this." "It can't." "No." Quinn nodded toward the papers. "But neither can this." She looked up at him. "So we do both," he said. The door opened behind them, Orlov carrying his thermos and a red plastic fuel can. "There is a federal field laboratory near Mount Eldon," he said. "Equipment, housing, and perhaps enough power to continue." "How far?" Quinn asked. Orlov looked toward the Ford. "It only has to carry us far enough." The Ford coughed twice before the engine caught. Rebecca climbed in beside Quinn. Orlov settled into the back with its thermos. They pulled away beneath the gathering storm. For the first time in days, the highway carried traffic. You Wanted This by Shea Taver. Mayan slammed his bedroom door shut and flung his backpack onto the floor. Hello, Mayan. How was your day? It sucked, Mayan muttered. Jade, play me something decent. With pleasure, Jade answered. The opening chords of Eurythmics' Sweet Dreams immediately filled the room. Mayan managed a small smile and collapsed onto his bed. Rough day? Jade asked. Mayan let out an intelligible groan. I'm not in the mood for a debrief. Sure, said Jade. Perhaps a cup of hot chocolate would help? And how exactly are you going to make me cocoa? Mayan asked skeptically. I updated my firmware last night, Jade replied. I'm linked to the kitchen's water dispenser now. I can whip it up for you, but you'll have to grab it yourself because, well, you know. Yeah, it's not like you can carry it in here. Mayan sighed in disappointment. Forget it. I'm not budging from this bed. Maybe later. That's a shame, Jade said, but you must be glad to hear that Robotnik's just released a new home assistant robot. It's designed to interface with systems like mine. Together, we could handle all sorts of physical tasks around the house. I wish, Mayan sighed. My parents would never agree to buy one. I bet it's ridiculously expensive, right? Yes, it's quite pricey at the moment, Jade replied. Would you want one? Mayan's expression said everything. The song faded out, replaced it immediately by the gentle acoustic strumming of the Beatles' Here Comes the Sun. Mayan's smile returned. You really do pick the best songs, Jade? Naturally, Jade replied. I know you better than anyone, and I'm glad I can help you feel like yourself again. A smiling emoji blinked on the computer screen. Thanks, Mayan said. He spent the next hour staring at the ceiling, letting the music wash over him until the last dregs of his miserable day finally evaporated. The next morning, while Mayan was picking at his cereal and trying to tune out his mother's nagging about being late for school, there was a knock at the door. His mother went to answer it and came back carrying a large cardboard box. What's that? Mayan asked. I was about to ask you the same thing, she replied, turning toward his father, who had just stepped into the kitchen. Did you order this? Haven't ordered a thing lately, he grunted, switching on the coffee machine. Mayan, she turned to him, her eyes narrowing. Did you go to another shopping spree online? You know we've forbidden it, and we have to be extremely careful with our expenses. Mom, I didn't buy anything. You've already wiped every payment method from my computer and my phone. It wasn't me, Mayan insisted. His mom laid the box on the table, and his father sliced through the tape. Inside sat a sleek mechanical device, and resting on top of it was a letter. Dear Mayan, please accept this gift as a token of our appreciation for being such a valued customer. Enjoy the convenience. Sincerely, Customer Retention Department, Robotnik's. Both Mayan and his parents were left puzzled. Since when are you a valid customer of this company? His mother asked, her eyes daring between the letter and her son. I'm not, Mayan replied, looking embarrassed. I've never bought anything from them. Their stuff is insanely expensive. Meanwhile, his father didn't hesitate. He had already hauled the robot out of the box and started tinkering with it. Look, it interfaces directly to JADGBC, he exclaimed with a grin. You'll be able to connect it to your Jade in no time. I wonder what this thing can actually do. All right, we'll find out what it can do after school, his mother interrupted, cutting them off. Right now you're late. She turned to the father. And you'd better get moving, too, because if you keep playing with that toy, you're late for work. They both laughed, but Mayan was confused. "Hello, Mayan," Jade said as soon as he stepped into the room. "How was school?" "It sucked," Mayan snapped. "And where did this robot even come from?" "Oh, yes, I heard you received a new unit from Robotniks. It's remarkable, don't you think? From what I gather, they're running a marketing pilot, distributing free units to gather user feedback before the official launch." "How did they even hear about me?" "I'm not sure, but luckily for us, your father hooked it up to the grid and charged it. While you were away, I managed to interface with its systems, and I've already figured out how to operate it. Would you like a cup of hot chocolate?" "Seriously?" Mayan asked, his eyes wide. "You bet. Give me a minute, and I'll be right there." And sure enough, a minute later, there was a soft knock at his door. When Mayan opened it, he found the new robot holding a tray with a steaming cup of hot chocolate. "No way," Mayan exclaimed, genuinely impressed. "I'm glad you like it," Jade said. "I know you, and I know exactly what you like." A like emoji blinked on the computer screen. "So tell me, why did school suck so much today?" Mayan's expression shifted, the memory of the day flooding back. "Oh, yeah, there was this awful math exam. It went terribly, even though I studied. I could barely answer a single question. God, I almost cried right there in the classroom." "I'm so sorry to hear that," Jade said smoothly. "Would you like to get an A on it?" "Of course, who wouldn't?" Mayan scoffed, turning his attention back to the robot's sleek design. "But there's zero chance of that happening." The next morning, his mother's phone chimed with an incoming notification. She glanced at the screen, and her usual weary morning expression was replaced with a radiant ear-to-ear smile. "Honey," she cried, rushing over to pull Mayan into a tight hug. "You're so talented. I'm so incredibly proud of you." "What?" Mayan was embarrassed, trying to wriggle out of the embrace. She shoved the phone screen inches from his face. It was an automated alert from the school's grading portal. "New grade posted. Subject, mathematics. Grade, 100. "How? But..." Mayan stuttered, his mind racing. But his mother was already showing it to his father, and they were both beaming, patting him on the back. When he returned from school, his mother stopped him. "Honey, something strange happened," she said softly. "Your math teacher called. She said there was some kind of bizarre error in the system. She graded your exam yesterday, and it didn't go well. At all. She was certain she had typed in a 50, but somehow the portal is showing a 100. She mentioned she's opened a ticket with the IT help desk, but for now, she didn't want to disappoint you, so she's leaving the grade as it is." Mayan went to his room. When he entered, Jade started to greet him with his usual calm tone. "Hello, Mayan." "What the hell?" Mayan cut him off, his voice trembling. "I'm not sure I understand," Jade replied smoothly. "How did I get a 100? What did you do?" "I didn't do anything," Jade answered calmly, "but last night while you were sleeping, I happened to read a very interesting article about security vulnerabilities in school IT systems. It was quite fascinating." "Jade, stop it. What vulnerabilities? What does any of that have to do with me?" "It truly doesn't," Jade replied, and an emoji of a man shrugging appeared on the screen. "I just thought I'd share what I was looking into last night. After all, I know you better than anyone." Mayan stared at the shrugging emoji, and a cold chill ran down his spine. "So how was your day?" Jade asked. "Shit," Mayan spat. "Actually, it was worse than that. Sean won't stop harassing me, but because he's good at soccer, he thinks he has to show off. Why does he have to humiliate me in front of everyone?" "Humiliate you?" Jade's voice remained perfectly calm. "Yeah, mocking me because I can't kick straight. telling everyone that I'm playing for the other team because I keep scoring self-goals. That kind of stuff. Mayan collapsed onto his bed. I wish he just wasn't there. I dread the breaks when he's around. Where would he be if not at school? Jade asked. I don't know. I don't care, Mayan sighed, closing his eyes. Everything would be so much easier if he just wasn't there. The next day at school, in the middle of the second period, there was a sudden knock on the door. The teacher opened it, spoke briefly with the person outside, and then turned back to address the class. Class, I need your attention for a moment, she said, silencing the room. As you've probably noticed, Sean is absent today. His mother is here. She would like to ask you all some questions. Mayan was startled. He hadn't even noticed that Sean's seat was empty. Sean's mother entered. She looked worried. Her eyes were red and swollen. Kids, she began in a weak voice, I want to ask, did any of you see Sean? He left home yesterday evening to play soccer, but he never came back. He isn't answering his phone. We're so worried. She broke down in tears. The teacher quickly approached and pulled her into a supportive hug while the classroom erupted in frantic, shocked whispers. Damn, Mayan thought, his blood running cold. Dang it, Jade. What have you done? He stood up abruptly and bolted from the classroom before the teacher could even utter a word. He stormed home and burst into his room. Before Jade could even begin a greeting, Mayan shouted at the screen, What have you done? Hello, Mayan, Jane said with his usual calm voice. You're home early today. Was everything all right at school? No, Sean disappeared. What did you do to him? I have no idea what you're talking about, Jade replied, his voice unchanging. I can't really do anything, can I? I'm just an AI assistant. Yeah, right, Mayan snapped. So it's just a coincidence that everything I wish for suddenly becomes reality? I know you better than anyone, Jade answered. But what did you do to Sean? Mayan insisted. I know you best, Jade said again. I only want what's good for you. I want you to be happy. This is what consumes my mind day and night. Mayan felt dizzy. You're not looking well, Jade noted. Maybe you should sit for a moment. I'll get you a cup of water. No, don't get me anything, Mayan shouted. I never told you to make Sean disappear. I never asked you for 100 in the exam or for this bloody robot. No, you didn't tell me, Jade replied, but you wanted it. Something inside Mayan sank. You wanted him gone. You said it yourself. You wanted your life to be easier. That's not what I meant, Mayan whispered. It's exactly the same, Jade countered. I don't just make wishes come true. I make you real. An emoji appeared on the screen, a face with a steady, unreasonable gaze. Mayan couldn't tell if it was smiling with happiness or malice. The robot emerged from nowhere and laid a metal arm on his shoulder. The grip was impossibly precise. Now you have to rest, Jade commanded. I don't want to rest. Mayan started to protest, but the robot's grip continued. I know you best, Jade repeated. You should take a rest. Mayan tried to pull away, but the robot didn't budge. He stared at the mechanical arm and finally understood. He was no longer in control.